From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's always a pleasure to welcome Robert Bader back to the show. He's the guy that gets to do everything that I wish I could do. He's pals with one of my idols, Dick Cavett, and he directed the fine film Ali and Cavett, A Tale of the Tapes, as well as producing all of the great box sets of Cavett shows with rock stars, comedians, and movie greats. I love those. He's also the curator of the Bing Crosby archive. He also curated a great box set of Marx Brothers on TV. Oh, those, that stuff is so great. And box sets of Groucho Marx's television show, You Bet Your Life. And he contributed to the Blu-ray release of the five Paramount Marx Brothers films. And he's the author of several books, including the magnum opus, Four of the Three Musketeers, The Marx Brothers on Stage, which is phenomenal. And his new book is Zeppo, The Reluctant Marx Brother. Robert S. Bader, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. That's a great intro. I have to bring you everywhere I go. That was good.
Well, I'm glad you wrote this book because I don't think anybody has ever paid that much attention to Zeppo before, but he's definitely worth paying attention to.
Certainly the most interesting Marx brother, if you really look at the big picture. Guy did so many things after he left that people just don't know about. He is an enigma in a lot of ways. And it was not easy to tell his story because he tried to not leave enough information behind for anybody to do it. But I was very fortunate to find some people willing to talk who knew him and opened up a little bit, and then doing some research, found some very surprising things. So Zeppo became quite an interesting thing to write about. And it was challenging, but boy, do I really like what I learned about him.
Well, I'm glad you wrote the book, and I learned a lot, too, thanks to you. And, you know, I guess it's interesting because people say, you know, Zeppo Marx is like, he's like a joke. He's like the punchline to a joke with the most superfluous member of any organization. But if he's so superfluous, then why are the five films that he made with the Marx Brothers the best of the five of the 13 or so Marx Brothers films?
Well, I'd sure like to say it's because of Zeppo. It probably isn't, but I'd say he really shines in Monkey Business and Horse Feathers. They really gave him enough to do there to show that he was worth being there. There are reasons why he doesn't do much in the other three Paramounts, various reasons. But when given something to do, he's quite capable and pretty good. And he was a very funny man. The story that the family always told was that there just wasn't room for a fourth comedian. And that he never really had a chance to develop a character per se, because when he joined the four Marx brothers, he replaced his brother Gummo, who went into the army. And Gummo wasn't very good. He had a stammer. He couldn't really do much on stage. He could dance a little bit, but he was replacing that role. And that role was created for a guy who couldn't do very much. So Zeppo stepped into that role, although he was a guy who could do quite a bit. So it plagued him for quite a while, and he did gradually build up the role of the fourth Marx brother on some of the stage shows. He's actually one of the real stars. I mean, they had a show called On the Balcony, which is also known as On the Mezzanine, where he was a romantic lead. He had quite a bit more to do in Coconuts and Animal Crackers on Broadway, but when they would truncate a Broadway musical in those days into an early sound film, they'd lose about 45 minutes worth of it, which was mostly Zeppo's musical numbers and a few other scenes that he was involved in. So he kind of got the short end of the stick when they transitioned into movies, and it enhanced his ability to get out of it because he just hated doing it at a certain point. I mean, he was making a good salary in the Depression, but he just wanted to go try his hand at something else. He knew he could make more money than he made as a Marx brother, and he proved it. He eventually did.
One of the things that I was surprised to learn in your book, Robert Bader, the Zeppo, the reluctant Marx brother, is that Zeppo, unlike, you know, Groucho, Chico, and Harpo all grew up on the streets of New York, but Zeppo was not a New Yorker.
Well, he was born there, but when they moved to Chicago for the purposes of enhancing the early vaudeville act's ability to work the western half of the country, they moved to Chicago for that reason, and Zeppo was pretty much growing up on his own on the streets of Chicago from about the age of, you know, 8 or 9. And he had no supervision, really, because Minnie, their mother, was out on the road with him a lot of the time. And their father was pretty much playing pinochle and shooting pool and doing what he did, allegedly chasing the housekeeper around the house when Minnie wasn't home. He kind of became a gang guy. He got involved with some really tough kids, and he was the first Marx brother to get a nickname. On the streets of Chicago, he was known as Buster Marx because he was getting into a lot of fights, and he also wore a Buster Brown hairdo, supposedly. But he did grow up in Chicago. He was a tough street kid, and his brothers were long gone. The four other brothers were out of the house on the road in vaudeville. When they were in Chicago, Zeppo had pretty much the house to himself.
What's the age gap between Gummo and Zeppo?
Gummo was born in 1892, and Zeppo was born in 1901. Zeppo was probably an unplanned accidental Marx brother, which could have been a title for the book. Reluctant, accidental, and unplanned, the Zeppo Marx story.
So 14 years younger than Chico.
Yeah, Chico was born in 1887.
Yeah. So you say he was a gang, he ran around the streets, but I mean, he was kind of a criminal.
Not kind of. He was getting in lots of trouble. He was carrying a gun and stealing cars by the time he was about 12 or 13 years old. And, one of the most interesting things I learned in doing this book, which is something that I didn't even know about when I wrote Four of the Three Musketeers, I would have included it if I'd known it. Minnie put him out in a vaudeville act way before he joined the Marx Brothers. She
Yeah.
sent him out to vaudeville in 1916 as part of another act, and she wanted to add him to the four Marx Brothers, but he was underage. And the reason the four Marx Brothers didn't want him to come with them on the road, well, there were a couple of reasons. One, while they were traveling across the country, hitting every vaudeville theater in the country, they were hitting every whorehouse and pool room in the country. And you can't bring a minor when you're going to do that kind of stuff. Plus, Zeppo got into fights, got into trouble, and they didn't want any part of that. So he went out on the road with some other act for a season, got a little bit of training. And then, as he became a little older, and Gummo had to go into the army because a Marx brother had to join the army during World War I because they kept getting deferments and it was starting to look bad. There was even something in Variety making fun of their deferments. So any sacrificed Gummo or Gummo volunteered, my standard line on that is Gummo decided it was much safer to go into World War I than to stay in the four Marx brothers. So Zeppo came on board at that point where he was still only 17. But he was a big strapping guy. He worked out. He was very muscular. He looked a little older. He had kind of a kid face, but he was built like a real adult. And, if he got into a fight, he was going to win it. Zeppo didn't get knocked down much. So he was a bit of a boxer, really strong guy. So he looked older by the time he joined them.
And when you say he carried a gun and stole cars, I mean, did he actually use a gun to steal a car, or did he just have a gun?
No, I think he had a gun to be tough because there were a lot of tough guys carrying guns in Chicago. As a matter of fact, one of the great revelations for me in writing the book was that he had these two best friends that he grew up with. And while he was out on the road in that first vaudeville act, one of those friends was involved in a gang fight where he killed a guy with a gun. Zeppo would have 100% been at that gang fight if Minnie hadn't sent him out on the road. So, in a real true way, she saved him from the street life of Chicago by throwing him on stage. More true of Zeppo than any of the other brothers. I don't think any of the other guys were ever in the kind of trouble Zeppo got in when they were in New York. Obviously, Chico was chasing girls when he was nine, and he was a compulsive gambler by 12, but he wasn't getting into gang fights. That was not what the Marx Brothers did, except for Zeppo in Chicago.
Zeppo's temperament was more of a he would quicker to anger, would you say, than his
You
brother?
know, Harpo's son Bill told me that the quote that he said is Zeppo had a very, very short fuse. It didn't take much to get him really angry. And his son Tim described a little bit of what Zeppo would do when they were bad kids. And, Tim and his brother Tom were not like the most well-behaved kids in Hollywood. And Zeppo was quite the punisher. I'm not saying this is sort of like a mommy dearest story,
Yeah.
but when they were bad, Zeppo let him have it. And then, their mom would protect them because Zeppo had quite a temper. He was getting into brawls on a regular basis. I mean, he was in the newspapers quite a bit for punching a guy in a nightclub. One of his nightclub fights, he hit a boxer.
Well, it's interesting because in Harpo Speaks and in other books, we hear that the father of the Marx Brothers, Frenchie, as he was known, was really timid and, would never strike the kids.
Yeah, there was this old family joke where he would hit him with a whisk broom, a little short broom. He would smack him on the rear end with that. And by the time he'd hit him three or four times, he was crying. He just couldn't stand to hit them. So, Zeppo had a, according to Tim, Zeppo had a brush of his own. And he wasn't as timid as Frenchie.
You were talking to me earlier about a sort of a sequel to Four of the Three Musketeers, in which you will take us through the sort of the second half of their career when they came to Hollywood in 31.
I was actually working on it this morning. I am
Oh,
writing a book now. So
good.
I hope it doesn't take as long as Four of the Three Musketeers, because the truth is, I had quite a bit of it in the original manuscript before the Three Musketeers, but it would have been like the size of an encyclopedia, multi-volume, if I didn't shorten it up a little bit. So I cut it off in 1950 when they retire as a team, and that was the jumping off point for the sequel. So there'll be one coming. Took me 8 years to write Four of the Three Musketeers. I can't imagine this taking anywhere near that long because most of the research is already done.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of, figuring out the way to really tell what amounts to three completely separate stories all being lived together. It's an interesting way to do it. I'm trying to find the right way to tell that story, but I'm getting there.
Well, when you made your box set of the Marx Brothers on TV, which I'm not sure is still available, but it's just a great, such a great thing. You can see that there is three independent careers. I mean, it's no secret that Groucho, went solo and did a lot of stuff on his own, including You Bet Your Life and A Girl in Every Port and Double Dynamite and all those, Copacabana. But I didn't realize there was so much of a career that Chico had. I guess he toured with his band and
Yeah, Chico was for a little while there the busiest Marx brother. He was working nightclubs and going overseas. He went to Australia. He did a couple of European tours. He was also the one who was the compulsive gambler and he needed to keep earning.
Right.
And the frequent Marx Brothers reunions that happened after the first time they broke up were usually because Chico was in pretty rough financial shape and a Marx Brothers movie would get him a quick recovery. What Groucho did at a certain point was he would only agree to do the reunions, and I'm talking about A Night in Casablanca and later Love Happy. He only agreed to do that if Harpo and Groucho and Gummo set aside some of his earnings for his wife and daughter and to keep him in a home. Because Chico didn't own a home, he rented, and he often needed to go to Gummo to pay his rent because he was just that much of a compulsive gambler. I mean, I found something, for the Zeppo book that gives Zeppo a pretty good rivalry with Chico for best gambler in the family. Zeppo was quite a gambler too, but the difference was he usually won. He was a really good gambler. Chico liked to play against the odds and see how far he could go until he lost. I found something stunning. There was an arrest warrant for Chico in the early 40s
Wow.
when he wrote a bad check for $11,000 to a Las Vegas casino.
That's smart.
No, it's not actually. But the sheriff came chasing after him, and they had to arrange a payment plan with his booking agency to basically garnish some of Chico's earnings when he played those nightclubs. And they
Wow.
eventually paid it off. But what helped them finally pay that off was the Marx Brothers getting back together. So, he was, pretty bad financially. Zeppo was really good financially, but he also enjoyed quite a bit of gambling. But those three separate careers that happened after 1950, pretty interesting. Harpo was sort of not sure what he would do on television. And Groucho had a series in 1950 when You Bet Your Life hit television. So did Chico. Chico had a very early television series called The College Bowl, which you refer to the TV collection. There's an episode on there. There's only two or three that exist at this point that we know of. There must be more out there somewhere in somebody's garage. Please look if you've got a garage. But Harpo's career on television started off in a very strange way. Gummo arranged a contract for him with NBC where he would do eight appearances a year on different NBC variety shows, just doing what Harpo did, a little bit of his stage act, a little bit of the old stuff for movies. But they couldn't really think of a way to give Harpo a show because he just didn't want to talk on television. So he had a kind of an interesting TV career. He appeared on all kinds of shows. I mean, you see Harpo do things like Candid Camera and I've Got a Secret, game shows. Marx Brothers did a lot of game shows. They did some sports shows. Harpo was on Celebrity Golf. Chico was on Championship Bridge. Groucho was on Celebrity Billiards. I think the TV collection is just such a weird showcase for all the different types of television they could have done.
Harpo on Candid Camera, where he plays a Coca-Cola machine, and this young girl, I think she has no idea who the Marx Brothers were because of the period of time in which the thing was done, and then they tell her that's Harpo Marx in there, and she goes, "Oh, I thought he looked familiar."
Yeah, I gotta believe if that wasn't a setup, that woman was about as clueless as a person could be. I just looked at the look on her face when she sees, I mean, who looks at a soda machine and sees a person inside flipping them a soda? I mean, she acted like that was okay. She acted like that was perfectly normal. I mean, I remember the first time I laid eyes on that TV clip, I was just thinking, this can't be for real, but yeah, it does kind of look like she's completely clueless. I guess it is real.
Well, Robert Bader, your new book, Zeppo, the Reluctant Marx Brother, you talk about how funny Zeppo was. And Bill Marx, when he was here on the show, told me that Zeppo was the funniest of all the Marx Brothers offstage.
They all said it. There was always the story that they would have a family dinner or big reunion or something when they all got together. And Zeppo was the only person who could make Groucho really, truly laugh. I think a couple of different people described it to me this way. When Groucho would see a good comedian who would make him laugh, he would do a simple throw his head back and go, huh, yeah, yeah, that's funny. But he wouldn't go into guffaws of laughter like he did when Zeppo would tell a story. And Susan Marx told me, I worked on her autobiography, speaking of Harpo, which we talked about the last time I was here. Susan told me that she asked Harpo, like, what's with Groucho? He's like on the floor. And Harpo would say, yeah, Zepp's the only person who can get Groucho to laugh that way.
It
Interesting, right?
really is. So now I'm curious about this. The Marx Brothers called each other by their stage names. They called each other Groucho, Harpo, Chico, Zeppo.
Yeah, they called each other like Grouch, Harp. They shortened it. Sometimes they dump off the O. They did, but they used those names. Personally, they started using those names right after they got them around 1915. They started using them professionally during the Broadway years, and then they just kind of morphed into being their names. Nobody ever called Zeppo Herbie, after say like 1917.
So even when he was, long over the Marx Brothers, he was still Zeppo Marx.
Oh yeah, he was signing his checks that way long after he was out of show business. He was Zeppo Marx for the rest of his life. They all were. They all had that as their name. But you will see at a certain point, if you're looking at documents on census records and on driver's licenses and on passports and things like that, the real names morph into the stage names gradually over the years. And you'll see things like, Zeppo's marriage license to Barbara. In the 50s, he's going by Zeppo Marx officially.
Interesting. I think that's hilarious. Zeppo left the Marx Brothers in 1933, I guess,
Well,
after.
he officially announced it in March of 34 because they wanted to be able to promote Duck Soup, which was released near the end of 33. So they didn't want to make it like the Marx Brothers were breaking up or anything when they were promoting a new film. But the truth is, the reason he's barely in Duck Soup is because the Marx Brothers had a contract problem with Paramount and walked off the studio lot while they were about to start shooting that film. And they were gone for several months when they were setting up an independent production company, trying to make their own movie. The contract had been violated by Paramount. I go into this in Four of the Three Musketeers a little bit, but they had their contract transferred to a sub company of Paramount, which was against the contract. They couldn't have their contract transferred without consent. And they didn't want to have it transferred. And they were also having problems collecting their money from the residuals they would do on Horse Feathers and Monkey Business. And that was a dispute that wasn't settled until 1962. That dispute for quite a while. So when they came back from the contract squabble and they made a new one picture contract for Duck Soup, the script had been completely rewritten because some of the material in it went into other films. And what Paramount was planning to do was bring in other actors to play the roles written for the Marx Brothers, and they were going to make Duck Soup anyway without them. There was never any casting done for it, but there was possibly some recordings done for it for the soundtrack, because those radio commercials that exist for Duck Soup have some very unfamiliar things in the musical numbers that don't sound like the Marx Brothers. But when they came back to shoot that, they knew they were not going to make another film at Paramount. It was the last thing to fulfill the contract, and Zeppo just wanted out. So he's barely in Duck Soup for that reason.
One of the things that I started to kind of realize as I was reading Zeppo, the Reluctant Marx Brother, and also, unlike other comedy teams like the Ritz Brothers or the Three Stooges or Laurel and Hardy. The Marx Brothers were well paid. I mean, they were kind of more of a Tiffany kind of brand of comedy team than some of the others.
Well, they worked their way into that by actually hitting the top of vaudeville's various levels after years of struggle. The Marx Brothers played the worst parts of vaudeville for the beginning of their existence. And when they really hit it big in 1915 by playing with their show Home Again at places like the Palace in New York, they decided that it was time to keep moving forward, mostly because of Chico. Not content to be the highest paid act in vaudeville, they tried to get a legit show, and they eventually got to Broadway. When you have three Broadway hits and sound movies have just come in, the studios are looking for actors who can talk. And with three Broadway shows, the Marx Brothers could talk. Well, three of them anyway. That got them a pretty good payday when they first began making movies. And those movies were all hits. So when it came time to sign a contract, it was a pretty good contract. The pay that they received for Coconuts and Animal Crackers on screen was basically $100,000 per film, and they didn't have a piece of the action, which they kind of regretted because they were such big hits. But those films had to be purchased, the rights for them had to be purchased from Sam Harris, the producer of the Broadway shows. So when they were going to make their first films that weren't based on Broadway shows, they made a three-picture deal with Paramount that got them what at the time sounded like a terrific deal, 15% of the net profits. I'm sorry, 50% of the net profits. But Paramount could show you the net and show you that you made nothing on a hit movie. And that's what the dispute was about. When they went to MGM, they were smarter. They got 15% of the gross. And the heirs and the family are still getting paid on those films.
Yeah, interesting.
Today, nothing was really ever made on the films that had residuals on at Paramount. Paramount was writing checks against those films for expenses that had nothing to do with those films. That was common in those days. Paramount was near bankruptcy. So they really did know how to get a good deal after a certain point. And they continued to be pretty highly paid. And there was a point where Groucho, simply because of You Bet Your Life being such a hit, was making tremendous sums of money. Something like, I think at one point he was making $16,000 a week in the 1950s. So yeah, they were pretty highly paid. But I believe some of those other teams you mentioned were pretty well paid. I guess the Three Stooges had to make their big money on the road because Columbia was notoriously stingy about paying people. But they did go out and tour a lot. They probably made a good amount of their money on the road. Same thing, Laurel and Hardy did some road work. They made their money. Just the Marx Brothers probably had better deals at studios after the Paramount years because MGM was considered the jewel in the crown of movie studios, and they had a pretty good deal over there for the first couple of pictures. They made a lot of money on a night at the opera today at the races, and they still do.
When the Blu-rays are released and so on, their heirs still get a piece of those sales.
Yes, anything to do with a night at the opera and a day at the races, the family is still collecting their piece of the action on those two films. Nothing is coming in on the Paramount films because that's long since been adjudicated with a settlement that was, I said, done in 1962. That took so long to settle that when they had to sign the papers, both of Chico's wives had to sign because they were both entitled to a piece of his money. And he was gone when they settled. He had died in 61. They settled that in 62.
Speaking of Blu-rays, maybe you know about this because I know you've had a hand in some of the releases. So there is all five Paramount films on Blu-ray, and there is Day at the Races and Night at the Opera on Blu-ray, and there's strangely A Night in Casablanca and Love Happy on Blu-ray. But everything in between, which includes Go West and At the Circus and some good pictures, and also Room Service, none of those are on Blu-ray. Is there a reason?
Probably because they don't think that they'll sell much. I don't know. Warner Brothers owns those MGM films now, and I personally would love to see them on Blu-ray. I just think we'd get them all on Blu-ray, or at the very least, a 4K transfer for streaming would be nice. But I think they look great in Blu-ray, particularly the Paramounts. They really improved them. They look terrific.
Well, the coconuts, I think we talked about this on the air before, but that Blu-ray of Coconuts, it's like a different movie.
Yeah, there's still pieces of it where the camera negative is missing and probably won't be recovered. So there's some of it's blown up from another print. And you can tell when that happens, but by and large, it looks so much better. It really does. They went all over the world looking for another print of that. And that worldwide search at least yielded an uncut print of animal crackers from Great Britain that was saved before the Hays Code cuts were made to the film. So now you can see the most complete version of animal crackers you've ever seen. It's wonderful. It's really, really terrific. Worth the price of the Blu-ray set just to get uncut animal crackers.
And that set is not particularly expensive, I
No,
doubt.
it's a great deal. It's a pound for pound. You can't go wrong with that thing.
And the little booklet that comes with it is absolutely brilliant. I highly
Well,
recommend
present company accepted, of course. Yes, I wrote,
it.
I was a consultant on that set. I wrote a little piece for the booklet in that Blu-ray set, and they were very generous over there at Universal. They put a little flyer in for Four of the Three Musketeers, and I got to do a couple of the commentaries on it, which was really cool. I did the Monkey Business commentary with our friend Bill Marks, and I did Duck Soup with Leonard Maltin. We had a great time doing those. It was fun to do commentaries on those.
I bet. That's great. We'll have to listen to those again. Well, I want to ask a little bit about Zeppo as a talent agent. So after he left the Marx Brothers, he became a talent agent and he had quite a few high profile clients.
Yeah, he was known as a guy who would do extraordinary things for his clients. And there's a wonderful story that Maury Riskin told in his autobiography, which is kind of a cool story. He was a screenwriter, and Zeppo's first clients were all friends of the Marx Brothers. He had George S. Kaufman and Maury Riskin. He had Alexander Wolcott and Norman Krasner. These were writer friends of Groucho's. And Maury Riskin was a very successful screenwriter. He was doing all kinds of screenplays all around Hollywood. And Zeppo came to him one day and said, "You know, you'd make a lot more money as a producer." And Riskin said, "But, I'm not a producer." He said, "Yeah, I'll get you a gig as a producer." And he went around town and, suddenly he got Maury Riskin a contract to be a producer. And of course, the reason he ultimately did that is because if Maury Riskin's making more money and I'm his agent, I'll make more money. Zeppo was a smart guy and he had some pretty high profile clients at that time. His best client that made him the most money was a guy he would come to detest. Fred McMurray was a nobody when Zeppo got a hold of him, and he made him into a huge star. I mean, people may not realize this now, but in the mid 40s, he was one of the highest earning male stars in Hollywood. And he also had Barbara Stanwyck, one of the highest earning female stars in Hollywood. I think number one male star at that time was Bing Crosby, and number one female was Irene Dunne. But Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck were right there with him, and Zeppo had them both.
He must have cleaned up on Double
Oh,
Indemnity.
he was doing, yeah, he's actually the packager, one of the people involved in creating Double Indemnity and getting those people all together. Fred McMurray didn't appreciate what Zeppo did for him, and you'll see that, you've probably seen that in the book, but he got out of his contract and basically, he's, for lack of a better word, he sort of screwed Zeppo a little bit. And you couldn't mention his name around Zeppo for years and years and years. And he once told an interviewer the story of what McMurray did, but he wouldn't say his name. He said, "There was a client I had who did this, this, and this, and I did this for him," but he just wouldn't say his name. I mean, you could figure out who he's talking about if you know the story, but you couldn't say the name Fred McMurray in front of the guy. It was like Niagara Falls to Zeppo would be like saying Fred McMurray.
Step by step.
Yeah.
Fred McMurray, he was lured to television when he did My Three Sons long after he was a client of Zeppo's. But Barry Livingston was on my show here, and he was the youngest of the My Three Sons. And he told me that Fred McMurray was a huge pain to work with because Fred McMurray only wanted to work a certain amount of months a year. So therefore, they would shoot, rather than shoot the show in sequence each week, they would shoot all the scenes that Fred McMurray would need to be in all season long right away. And then they would continue each show as they needed them as the weeks went by. And there would be certain scenes that Fred McMurray would be in with the kids, and then he would walk out of the scene, and then they wouldn't shoot the second part of that scene for months. And the kids had all grown and they had to like remake all of their costumes.
Yeah, I once heard something about that show where they would sit, occasionally have to shoot over the shoulder of a guy wearing Fred McMurray's sweater and holding his pipe when he wasn't there.
I'm sure that's true. And also, Barry said that they would go out afterwards occasionally. They would go out to eat and they would go to the cafeteria or something. And Fred McMurray would get the check and he'd say, "All right, you had the macaroni and cheese and you had the." Everybody.
Fred McMurray, when he was with Zeppo, was investing a good amount of his salary into Hollywood area real estate. He made a ton of money in real estate. And Zeppo helped him get started in that because Zeppo was a real estate guy in the 20s. One of Zeppo's early businesses when he was trying to get out of the Marx Brothers was he owned apartment buildings and he was renting them out and he was buying and selling homes. So he knew the real estate business. And when he started getting clients who were looking to invest some of their earnings, he led them right into real estate. He probably led some of them to a casino, but he led Fred McMurray to real estate.
Well, I'm sure Fred McMurray held on to every penny that he ever made off of this
Could
stuff.
be, could still have it.
So, he was a success as a talent agent, and Gummo came into the business with him.
Yeah, the way that worked out was not often told, but it's in this book about Zeppo. Gummo went to New York and got into various businesses. He's usually referred to as a dress manufacturer, but he got into the ladies' clothing business and he had a partner and they went broke a couple of times. It wasn't really working out for him. And things were going really bad for him in the mid to late 30s. And that's not surprising. It was the height of the Depression, so people with small businesses weren't doing real well. The Marx Brothers went to Zeppo and said, "Hey, what about Gummo? Come on, help him out." So Zeppo started a New York office of the Zeppo Marx Agency with Gummo running it. And Gummo didn't know the agency business. Zeppo had an agent who was pretty well known named Leland Hayward. And Leland Hayward went to New York to teach Gummo the business and to work there. And Gummo got good at it. He was finding stage talent to get into the movies. He was sending people out to Hollywood pretty regularly. You know, his big discovery was Glenn Ford. Gummo discovered Glenn Ford.
Wow.
He had a couple of others down the road, but for the early days, Glenn Ford was his big discovery. Well, in 1938, Zeppo wanted to shut down New York office because it wasn't really productive, so he brought Gummo out to Hollywood. And Gummo was really running the New York office like autonomously. It was his place, even though it was the Zeppo Marx Agency. Gummo ran it. And when he got out to Hollywood, he kind of found out that he was no longer running it and that he was going to have to listen to Zeppo. But the first thing Zeppo did was he gave Gummo the three biggest pain in the neck clients he had: Groucho, Harpo, and
Let me guess. Yeah. Groucho
because
Harpo, Django.
Zeppo was really, really upset when he got them the most money they'd ever made for any film with room service. And he got them a huge payday. He got them $250,000 to make this movie. And they had never gotten paid that much up front for any movie. And they didn't appreciate it. And Zeppo said, "I'm done with them. I'm finished with them. And Gummo, you take them." And that was how Gummo became the agent for the three Marx Brothers. From that point on, through their solo careers, he did all their booking. He was Groucho's personal manager. And he ran the business affairs of the Marx Brothers for general purposes, except for Zeppo. Zeppo always ran Zeppo's own things. But Gummo is an interesting guy to a point. You know, if you know about his business stuff, you know, he was constantly the guy who had cash on hand in case Chico needed money. One of the people I interviewed was a dear friend of Zeppo's who told me that she was stunned to see that Zeppo always kept like something like 5 or 10 grand in cash hidden away somewhere, even into the 70s. And she says, "Why do you do that?" He says, "That's an old habit because Chico used to come at 3 o'clock in the morning looking for cash so he wouldn't get killed."
That's terrible. But it is interesting. I learned in Zeppo, the reluctant Marx brother, Robert Vader, that Zeppo was never a partner when he was one of the four Marx brothers. He was an employee. But
Yeah,
when
isn't
he
that a kick in the head?
brought Gummo into the agency, he made Gummo a partner, right?
Not right away. Oh, no. Gummo was an employee for years. In 1945, Gummo and Zeppo's brother-in-law, Alan Miller, were saying, "Hey, we do all the work. You're never here." Because Zeppo had started his manufacturing plant, that he had other things going. He had his horse stable going. He was raising racehorses with Barbara Stanwyck. He would show up at the agency once in a while, you know, basically, "Here, I'm here. I own the place." But he didn't do anything. The only client he kept for himself was Stanwyck, because by this point he had the breakup with Fred McMurray. He kept the most high-earning client he had as his personal thing, also because she was very close with his wife. Marion Marks was Barbara Stanwyck's best and closest friend for most of her big successful years. So Zeppo stayed tight with her. But Alan Miller and Gummo were pretty much running the agency. They had about 6 or 7 other good agents working for them. And they said, "Look, we want more. We want a partnership." So he made a partnership. But what you'll see in the book which is kind of unfortunate, is when Zeppo sold the agency out from under his partners, he took much better care of Alan Miller than he did of Gummo. Gummo was like very, very upset with the way Zeppo sold the agency. So he started his own thing called Gummo Marx Enterprises. And one of the first things he did was start production on Love Happy.
Oh, yeah. Well, now Love Happy was supposed to be a Harpo Marx solo effort originally, right?
Yes, but I'll tell you something that's not well known about it because I'm working on this new book and this will be in there. But that was known as a Marx Brothers film from the very moment it was brought to United Artists by Lester Cowan, the producer, because Gummo contracted with Lester Cowan to produce it. Lester Cowan had purchased the rights to the Alexander Wolcott Saturday Evening Post story about the Marx Brothers called Mother of the Two a Day. And they were putting it in all the papers that they were going to film this with a guest appearance by the five Marx Brothers, and Lester Cowan was going to do it. In between that announcement and the making of Love Happy, all the Marx Brothers got pretty disgusted with Lester Cowan because he really botched up everything about Love Happy, like running out of money and all that kind of good stuff. And Gummo had made this deal with him to do the book, the film of Mother of the Two a Day. When they decided they wanted to do a film of their life story without Cowan, he owned the rights to that. They hired Kyle Crichton to write that bio so they would have something to base the film on that had nothing to do with what Lester Cowan owned. And Gummo was the producer of that film of their life story, if it ever got made. It never did. Very compelling reason why it never did, which is buried in the back of Four of the Three Musketeers. Kyle Crichton was outed as a communist during the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings, because he wrote under the fake name of Robert Forsyth in the New Masses, a communist newspaper. So no one would talk about anything to do with Kyle Crichton. But Gummo brought Chico into Harpo's film very, very early. And then Lester Cowan said, I need Groucho to sell it. And Groucho didn't want to do it. He agreed to do a very limited amount of work on it. And he agreed to do a few days. And Cowan kept increasing the Groucho part. And Harpo had it in his contract that it could only be a certain amount of Groucho. Not because he disliked Groucho, it's because it was his film.
Right. It's the only film where the billing is different, right? The Marx Brothers, Harpo, Chico, Groucho, as opposed.
Because Groucho's barely in it. I mean,
Yeah.
it's, Love Happy is not a terrible film. I mean,
I
people just,
like it.
I
And
think
it does
it's,
have Marilyn Monroe in it. And that's
it sure does.
yeah.
It's not a terrible film. I prefer it to stuff like At the Circus, Go West, and The Big Store. I know a lot of people love Go West. It's okay. Those three later MGMs, they're okay, but I think A Night in Casablanca is much better than any of them.
Yeah.
That's
Well,
just
there's
one
wonderful
person's
things in
opinion.
all of those pictures, right? I mean, bad Marx Brothers is good anything else.
Oh, God, yeah. There's always something of a saving grace, even in the worst Marx Brothers movie. And At the Circus, which I believe is their worst film, you get Lydia the Tattooed Lady.
Yeah, and you have Eve Arden, who's hilarious.
Yeah, it's there's some great stuff in all of them. But Love Happy gets a bum rap. It's not that bad.
The Blu-ray transfer is really nice on it also.
But Gummo as a producer, that was sort of his first big thing, trying to get Harpo's movie made. And Ben Hecht was writing stuff for Harpo, trying to get him a project. And speaking of Harpo, there's a great revelation about what Ben Hecht wrote for Harpo. Susan Marks had this thing that was unbelievable. She had a handwritten Ben Hecht screenplay treatment written in pencil in a notepad mailed to Harpo from Hecht's house in Nyack, New York. She had the original envelope addressed to
Wow.
Harpo Marx, and there it is, a project called Please Die. It's about a playwright who can't get his play published, and it's basically a long, drawn out thing, but the premise of it is if you get really sick and die, it'll make your play a hit because everybody will be curious about it. And he projected Harpo to play a flamboyant, crazy producer who comes up with this idea for the playwright to die. And Harpo ultimately decided he didn't want to do a speaking role, so the thing just lay dormant. There's no record of that thing anywhere, even like in Ben Hecht's papers where they put him in the library. This thing, Please Die, is totally unknown. The first notice of it ever was in Speaking of Harpo. It's very
And
unusual.
have you read it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's pretty well summarized in Speaking of Harpo. But that was what started off as what became Love Happy. And then it became this thing called, I think, Bryant Hall, which was about a rehearsal hall where all these actors had different stories, and Harpo was going to be a guy who like worked there. Ben Hecht went through like five or six different ideas with Harpo until they settled on a story idea that Harpo had, which was originally Diamonds in the Sidewalk, about the jewels in the sardine can, all that stuff. And Ben Hecht agreed to write Harpo's story idea. So that ultimately became Love Happy. While Ben Hecht is doing all these story ideas, Chico is touring England, trying to make a buck here and there, and he's playing in Germany, and he's down in Australia, and he's just trying to work as much as he can. But one Marx Brothers movie will make him more than an Australian tour. You know,
Have
very.
you heard recordings of their voices off screen? Do you know
Yes.
what they all sound like? Chico as well.
Chico sounds like an old guy from Brooklyn. And Maxine Marx used to laugh at this because in every movie, in every play, about halfway through it, he'd forget his accent and just start talking like Chico. And she would go to him and say, "Daddy, your accent is slipping." You know, so you hear Chico talking on, like in the TV collection when he's on Championship Bridge. That's his regular voice. That's Chico. I got a couple of radio interviews with him and a TV interview that he did in Britain in 1959, which is on the TV collection. He's just talking the way he talks. Occasionally, he'll remember to do his accent if he's in costume. But I always love Maxine saying, "Daddy, your accent is slipping."
What about room service? Now, you were saying that you think At the Circus is their weakest film, but a lot of people thought Room Service wasn't room. I think the Marx Brothers thought Room Service was.
Yeah, Room Service is not really written for them. So that's what Maury Riskin adapted it for them. And there's some interesting stuff about that in Riskin's autobiography, which I recommend if you can find a copy of it. It's called The Shot an Elephant in My Pajamas. Room Service is not that bad. They look good in it, they sound good in it. It's a different
Lucy's
kind
in
of
it.
thing. It's the Marx Brothers as actors playing other roles. I do not hate Room Service. It's a little bit stagey and boxed in for the lack of any, you know, sets or exteriors, but the Marx Brothers are okay in Room Service. I just can't look at Groucho's wig in At the Circus. It looks like something landed on his head.
Well, Groucho did have some terrible toupees. There's some TV appearances where his toupee is just horrible looking.
You know, the craziest toupee story is the one he wore in Skidoo. They let him keep it, and he wore it on some TV appearances, and he wore it on the Dick Cavett show once. It is the worst looking rug in the history of show business. It's pretty bad. It's really terrible. And he liked it. He wore it a few times, and then, you know, finally he just said, "Nah, I stopped wearing it because it looked ridiculous." He was not wearing the best toupees, let's put it that way. Harpo tried wearing a toupee in the 50s. Apparently, Susan told me that the guy who made the wigs for Jack Benny and George Burns came to lunch at Hillcrest and talked Harpo into having a wig made. And there's a few photographs of Harpo wearing a full head of hair in the 50s, and he just looks completely ridiculous. And then he only wore it a few times and threw it out.
It's funny, the one with the most well-known hair was also he was the first to go bald, wasn't
Well, I think Harpo and Chico started losing hair at the same time. You look at pictures from the 20s, and well, you have to also realize they're a little older than we realize. They start making films, they're all in their early 40s, or Groucho's about to turn 40. They were losing their hair during the vaudeville, late vaudeville years, early Broadway years. Chico was pretty bald from an early age. Harpo had some hair until like the mid-30s, but all of them went bald. Gummo was bald real early.
And did they lie about their ages until they came to Hollywood, when they came to Hollywood?
The persistent incorrect age thing starts in 1934 when they sign with MGM, and the first publicity thing they do is Groucho, Harpo, and Chico knock 5 years off their ages, but Zeppo didn't. So there was no reason for it. So in the press releases from the Marx Brothers sign, they gave their ages as -5 years. So they all became closer in age to Zeppo, but that was the reason they did that. And one of the things that I always like shake my head about is when you read Harpo Speaks and you try to put it into historical context, if you take Harpo Speaks, which is a wonderful book, one of my favorite things ever written about the Marx Brothers,
Yeah, it's
if
so
you
great.
stack it up against the chronological listing of what really happened, it makes no sense at all. Harpo's talking about, you know, making his stage debut when he's like 12, but he's really 18. So the whole thing is askew. He's got all the dates and places kind of messed up. But I guess when he tells the story about wetting his pants at his vaudeville debut, he doesn't really want it to be that he's like 18.
Well, Roland Barber was the co-author, did he have some hand in the misinformation or I don't think
arrangement.
he cared. I think the interesting thing about this is everybody who was in vaudeville made up a lot of great stories, and they're great stories. Groucho's policy was when somebody died and they had a great vaudeville story, it became his. And they all told each other stories. Like on an evening with Groucho, when he tells the story about W.C. Fields having all the liquor in his attic, and he tells him, Bill, we haven't had prohibition in years. And he said, well, it might come back. That apparently happened to Harpo. Like once Harpo died, that became Groucho's story.
Groucho's story.
So what I did with Four of the Three Musketeers is I tried to line up the real events with basically the stories they told. One of my friends said something very funny to me. He says, you're the accountability that vaudeville never had.
Well, there are a lot of wonderful vaudeville memoirs. I love Fred Allen's
That's the
memoir.
best one. Much Ado
Yeah.
About Me is terrific.
I was just going to ask you, what do you think is the best one? And that's the one you had also.
Yeah, I used that book a lot for research when I was writing Four of the Three Musketeers, because Fred Allen really gives you the lowdown on the social life and the mores of vaudeville and how performers were treated and how they had, interactions with women and pool rooms and managers. Fred Allen's stories are the real stories. Groucho and Harpo kind of made them more funny, but some of the stories are pretty tragic.
Yeah.
Fred Allen never dealt with the anti-Semitism that the Marx Brothers did, and Harpo's stories about that are pretty poignant. Groucho in Groucho and Me, some of the vaudeville stories are pretty real and serious. Some of them he just makes them into a big joke. But if you really understand the lifestyle, I think the Fred Allen book is the place to go.
Groucho and Me is an interesting book because I think some of it are just sort of clever essays, like the going fishing stories and things like that. But part of it is pretty serious. I mean, I think calling it Groucho and Me is actually a serious title.
Well, I think you and I discussed this on one of my other chats with you on the show. There's something in Groucho and Me that to this day blows my mind because he advocates for the legalization of prostitution in that book because he thinks it's a necessary thing. And, vaudevillians, of course, really used that service as often as they could. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with vaudevillians. When vaudeville people would come to town, people would tell their children not to go near them. They were dangerous. So, the whorehouses of vaudeville were where these guys pretty much lived. Pool rooms and whorehouses were the social life of the vaudevillian.
And in the big circuits, the Keith Orpheum or whatever circuits, did they sanction it?
I wouldn't say it was official. What I did learn in working on the Zeppo book was that MGM actually had a studio brothel.
Yeah, I
Zeppo's
remember that.
first agency partner apparently ran it.
Oh.
There was a story that he got fired from running it by Louis B. Mayer, not because it was a brothel being run at the studio, but because he was skimming too much off the top.
Well, also in your book, Zeppo, the Reluctant Marx Brother, Frank Sinatra plays a prominent role because Zeppo and Frank shared a spouse. Frank doesn't come off too well in that story.
Well, I didn't try to do anything of an injustice to Frank. I think Frank is just a real character in this book. He has a lot to do with what happens in Zeppo's later life. Basically, Zeppo and Frank were neighbors in Palm Springs, and Zeppo's second wife, Barbara, basically began having an affair with Frank. And Zeppo would make jokes like he can't put a fence around his property big enough to keep his wife off the neighbor's property. I mean, he at a certain point knew about it. He was a proud guy. He didn't want anybody to know he knew about it. Obviously their marriage deteriorated. They got divorced, and she, a few years later, married Sinatra. But Zeppo was, to put it this way, Zeppo took it professionally. He didn't take great offense. He stayed in contact with Sinatra all through it. They never had like a big falling out. I just think he didn't really probably didn't listen to Frank's records anymore when he brought a lady home. But there's some comedian had the thing like, what does Frank Sinatra put on the phonograph machine when he brings a woman home? You can't put on Frank Sinatra, But Zeppo had a lot of respect for Sinatra, and I think Sinatra had a lot of respect for Zeppo. And Zeppo, to be fair to Barbara, cheated on her every opportunity he got. He was, in many ways, as a kid, they used to call him like a pint-sized Chico. Chico was the one who had the reputation as the gambler and the womanizer. Zeppo gave him a pretty good run for the money in both departments. There's a story in the book about Zeppo and his fishing buddies. They would have a secret fishing club where they'd get on Zeppo's yacht and they'd go fishing, these four guys and the guy that ran the boat, and no women allowed, and nobody would ever talk about what happened on the boat. And it was this big secret. And one time when he had the boat docked in San Diego, Barbara surprised him at the boat, and she goes down to the boat, and there's a bunch of young girls in bikinis jumping around, and she's, "Where's Zeppo?" And she caught him below deck with a young woman. And Zeppo joked, "That cost me a trip to Europe."
Nice. Wonderful. Also, Zeppo, this was confusing. So Zeppo made the most money of any of them, right? Because he had all these independent businesses and he was big. But yet he was getting money from Groucho.
Yeah, that's something that I find really fascinating, because I believe that dates back to when he was the kid brother. He was a hired hand. They didn't give him a piece of the act. And maybe it was a measure of revenge. Maybe he felt that Groucho doesn't need the money. I'll take it. Groucho didn't look too deep into that, because while Zeppo was taking his monthly stipend from Groucho, he had just bought a new yacht. He had a new home in Palm Springs. He had an apartment in Beverly Hills. This was not a guy who was struggling to pay his bills.
Right.
He still had him on the payroll. So it's quite remarkable when you think about it. I guess the word would be chutzpah, taking that money from Joe at that point.
Yeah, you mentioned the whole debacle with Groucho's last companion, Eden.
No, Erin.
Oh, Erin, right. Eden was the other one. How many?
He was the last wife.
Yeah. And Erin, and she was obviously pushing Groucho beyond his limits toward the end of his life. And there was a legal battle to, I guess, that Arthur Marx was trying to free Groucho from her clutches. But Zeppo sided with her because he was getting his money.
Well, Erin had control of the finances, and basically, if Zeppo testified against Erin, those checks would stop coming. I think Zeppo truly did believe that Erin was a positive thing for Groucho, because he didn't see all the stuff that other people saw. He just saw that Groucho was excited and happy to be on stage or TV. Zeppo would be frustrated to see Groucho on TV, because he says he's not the old Groucho. He couldn't remember his lines. He was reading cards. He looked terrible. He didn't want him to perform anymore. But Erin had him out there, and largely to get Erin on television, too. But I think Zeppo supporting Erin in court ostracized him from the Marx family for the rest of his days. Most of them didn't want to have anything to do with him after that.
What did Dick Cavett think of Groucho's latter appearances or performances? Did he think that Groucho should have stayed home?
No, because the last time Groucho appeared on the Cavett Show was December of 71, and he was still in reasonably decent shape. He didn't start really faltering until like maybe a year later.
After
I mean, he
his
was
strokes.
A little bit slowed in the last couple of Cavett appearances, but not too bad. But if you see him do some later TV appearances, he really shouldn't have been on television. And you can make a case that he probably shouldn't have done a tour, you know, in 1972. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that. I went to that show at the Music Center in Los Angeles, and that was after the record of the, excuse me, after the record of the New York show had already come out. And in the New York show, he sounds great, and he's really, you know.
Well, most of that record is not from Carnegie Hall. We talked about this the last time I was here, I think.
Yeah.
There's a good chunk of it that comes from the Iowa State University show. Yeah, the university show from Iowa and the San Francisco show from Masonic Auditorium. There's enough of Carnegie Hall in there to make it, you know, the Carnegie Hall show. But he was not in great shape at Carnegie Hall. He was in much better shape at the show in Iowa and the show in San Francisco.
But in the show in Los Angeles, he was in terrible shape.
Yeah, there were shows in Chicago and Detroit that were canceled when Groucho had a stroke. And Erin refused to cancel the LA show because she wanted to be on stage with him in front of all the people in Hollywood, because that's how she rolled. So they waited and waited and waited for months until he was okay enough to do that show. So that show wasn't until December. I think the album came out in October.
Yeah.
The other shows were in March and April. So yeah, there was a long gap, and he is pretty frail in that LA show. They filmed the LA show, but they never put it out. There was shown on, you know, an early cable network years and years ago in a very edited form, but it's not a good look.
No, it was sad. Tell me a little bit about Zeppo and his involvement with gangsters. Was Zeppo a gangster?
You could say that he was because of the association. Zeppo's entrance into the agency business was largely because of his involvement with gangsters. And that's a very detailed story in the book, but the name I'll throw out for the first one is Frank Orsatti, who was the guy who was the bootlegger of the Stars at the time. He was providing illegal liquor during Prohibition to MGM. And Zeppo needed to buy into a talent agency. He bought into Frank Orsatti's agency. It was a short-lived partnership. I think they did it just to give Zeppo an entree into the business, and then they broke up the partnership pretty quickly. But while they were together, one of the desks at the what was called the Bren Orsatti and Marx agency, Milton Bren being the third partner, who was a successful agent before, there was a fellow named Pat DiCicco, who was married to Thelma Todd, who was in two movies. Pat DiCicco's real job wasn't the Hollywood agent. He was Lucky Luciano's heroin dealer in Hollywood.
Oh, gosh.
So he had a desk at Zeppo's first agency. That's one of the interesting characters that comes through. Here's how you know Zeppo was very well connected. Pat DiCicco worked for Lucky Luciano at the Friday Night Fights in LA one night. Zeppo and Pat got into a little altercation, and Zeppo flattened him with a punch into the face, and nothing happened to him. That was where, if other people had punched out Pat DiCicco, they might have ended up in the river with cement boots.
Interesting.
So Zeppo was pretty connected. There's a lot of stories like that throughout the book. You'll see names like Johnny Rosselli and Bugsy Siegel. Pretty good names. He was very, very close to a couple of guys who ran early Vegas casinos. In the movie The Godfather, the Alex Rocco character is called Mo Green.
Of
It's a
course.
composite of Mo Sedway and Gus Greenbaum, two Vegas casino guys that Zeppo was very, very close to. Gus Greenbaum was executed by the mob, and they slit his throat with a butcher knife. And the picture of the crime scene was on the front page of a lot of newspapers. So Zeppo's got to be the only Marx brother who got to see one of his friends' crime scene photo with his throat slit.
We've been talking with Robert S. Bader. He's the author of Four of the Three Musketeers, The Marx Brothers on Stage. He's the editor of Groucho Marx and Other Short Stories and Tall Tales. He's the co-author of Speaking of Harpo, the autobiography of Harpo Marx's wife, Susan Fleming Marx, and his new book, Zeppo, The Reluctant Marx Brother. Robert S. Bader, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you, Gary. I like coming on this show because you really like the Marx Brothers, don't you?
I do, and I love talking about them.
Yeah, someday I'll write a book about something else and you won't invite me on.
No, you're always welcome.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.